Vectis Radio, M104.6, the heart of the island's community.
This show is sponsored by Narconon UK.
Call Narconon today at 01435 512 460. 01435 512 460.
Hello and welcome to this week's edition of Wit, Wisdom and Pratfalls with me, Joan Ellis, and my very special guest, Dr. Kim Brown, Founder Director of Nature Therapy CIC. Welcome, Kim.
Thanks, Jamie. It's lovely to be here.
Can you tell us, so nature therapy, what's that all about?
Well, nature therapy is something that human beings have not devised, but nature's been part of human existence since time immemorial. And we've always looked to nature for healing properties down through thousands of years and across lots of different cultures. And nature therapy is really about learning lessons from the past on what can help us into the future, especially in terms of mental health and well-being. So we use nature therapy particularly around nourishing minds.
So would it be true to say that it helps people understand and start to really trust their senses?
Yes, it all the work we do is sensory based, and we tend to use very unique programs. So nature therapy can be anything from stroking a horse to digging a garden. And most people tend to think of gardening as part of the nature therapy or horticultural therapy.
So when you stroke a cat, it's meant to lower your heart rate, isn't it?
And yes.
Your blood pressure goes down.
That's
right. And so it's things like that. And is it also related to when people talk about having a gut feeling about something?
Yes.
That guides them?
Yeah. The work that we do, because it's sensory based, we help people get back in touch with nature through sensory experiences.
Like what, for example?
So it could be equine therapy involving horses. It can be forest bathing, which is an ancient Japanese tradition, which is all of these techniques we used have very sound research base to them. And we use a variety of different techniques. So we look at the research evidence. First of all, make sure that it can do no harm. We look at the risks involved with it. And then we involve nature in some way. So probably the one that's getting the most attention at the moment is the work that we do with wolves. So we run a program called Wolf Medicine, which is for people. Well, it started off originally for ex-veterans coming back from Afghanistan and places with post-traumatic stress disorder. And we had some funding from the Ministry of Defence to start a small program. And from that, we've developed this whole course called Wolf Medicine. For those with PTSD, there's often a link with addiction, trying to dampen down some of their symptoms. And also there's a link to being a highly sensitive person. So what we were doing as we started this work initially was finding these links. And then as we developed it, and they helped us develop it, we now use the program for people with addictions, who have experience of mental distress and mental illness, and also for anybody that needs a little bit of extra strength in their lives.
So, for example, if I were to sign up for that, what sort of thing would I be expected to do, interact with these wolves?
Okay, so Wolf Medicine is a 5-session, we run it as an intensive week, and it's 5 sessions, 5 different nature quests. So the first quest is really about finding your inner wolf. And we use a lot of Carl Jung's work around metaphors, and the wolf is a particular metaphor for strength and protection in our lives. And the ancients used animal medicine in this way to try and help them mentally become stronger. So, for example, if they were going hunting, they would try to invoke the strength of the wolf.
So it's
wolf.
Like channeling the wolf's strength and bravery.
That's right.
Okay.
As research is progressing in neuroplasticity, which is, we know that the brain's very, very flexible, and the brain itself cannot often tell the difference between what's real and what's not real. So hence, when you're watching a television program and something happens, it's a horror movie, and you go like this, and you get all the physiological reaction from that, because the brain doesn't know it's not real. It's really seen that scary thing come out and frightened you enough to set off a physiological response. So we use the science of neuroplasticity within this program. We also use the very practical aspect of real wolves.
Okay, and are they semi-tame?
Is there such a thing? Yeah. The wolves are just a small part of the programme. We use a lot of ancient knowledge. So we use things like labyrinths and medicine wheel, forest bathing. We involve horses. But the wolves, we haven't got any on the island. You'll be surprised to know, or maybe relieved. The nearest wolf centre is in Reading, so it's the Wolf Conservation Trust there. And they have 10 wolves there that have been bred in captivity. So they're not tame, but they are very used to humans. So what you do find with wolf populations around the world, and I've looked at running this programme in Portugal, for example, is you wouldn't see a wolf for dust if it saw a human, because we have a long, long history of slaughtering wolves and killing them. And so they see a human and they're gone, or they smell a human and they're gone. But these wolves in Reading, you can interact with them, but not physically. You can't physically touch them. So we interact with them through body language and through howling. And mainly it's about learning survival strategies of the wolf as well, and how you can relate them to your human existence.
We, as a nation, I think we tend to think of wolves in a very negative way, don't we?
We do.
You know, what is it, the sheep, wolf in sheep's clothing,
yes.
When we're describing a particularly chauvinistic male, for example. They've got a very bad name, haven't they?
Yes, and actually it's the name that they've got has come down through history. But in reality, for example, you'll call a man a wolf if he's always out seeking additional females. Mm-hmm. But wolves mate for life, and they're very, very loyal. And the family and the pack is their strength, and that's what they're there to fiercely protect each other. I mean, humans have an awful lot to learn from wolves in that sense.
Yes.
And there's also other aspects around a wolf. A wolf pack will care for its elderly and its sick. No wolf gets left behind. And when you see wolf packs moving, the slower individuals, the older, more vulnerable individuals, are kept in the middle of the line of wolves so that they can be protected from the front and the back.
That's quite unusual, isn't it, in the animal kingdom?
In the animal kingdom, there is a...
Because it's about the survival of the fittest, normally.
You're right. And often in herd circumstances, you will not see that type of loyalty. So, for example, wild horses, you might see a horse try to move another horse if they're unwell or sick, but eventually they will move on and leave that horse. Wolves have been known to be virtually starving and to catch some prey and carry it back in their mouth for the sick wolf. So it's like carrying back a chocolate cake and gifting it to someone else.
So, horrible question, but would they, when that sick animal eventually dies, would they then turn and eat that animal if they were desperate?
There is a possibility. I don't know that for sure, but I would imagine if it is again about survival of the pack, you might find the cubs, the younger ones, and there's very little food around. That might happen.
And I'm really interested in this forest bathing. That sounds beautiful.
Yes.
So, What does that, apart from the obvious, what does that entail?
Well, it's actually prescribed as a treatment in Japan. And the research around forest bathing shows that if we listen to birdsong, for example, for 20 minutes a day, it can really lower our stress levels, it can lower our adrenaline, our cortisol, it will really chill us out, basically. And so, of course, when you go into a forest, you've got a whole range of different things that impact on you at a physiological level. So the first is the sound, and people can become extremely stressed with sound levels, especially there's something called misophonia, which means you're particularly sensitive to sounds. some people find it when others chew their dinner.
Oh, yes.
Yes. So that's when you'll notice if someone has misophonia, there's usually other sort of ways of being attached to that. So they could be just misophonic, or they could be a level of Asperger's or autism or mental distress attached to that. So the first thing is the sound levels are different, and nobody objects to the sounds of birds, surprisingly, unless they're knocking on your bedroom window at 4 o'clock in the morning incessantly. So there's that level. So that affects your sound. Then also the smell. And they've done some interesting research around the smells in woodlands and the terpenes that are released within the forest and the different smells and how they impact on us, again, at a physiological level. And the sights, the feel of the wind or the breeze. So all of the senses are calmed by being in a forest. And also, of course, you haven't usually got other people around you. And
so when you say bathing, you're not talking about bathing in a lake in a forest. You're talking about bathing forest, in the senses that the forest offer up.
Yes, we do mud bathing, but that's another aspect where we do that as a nature quest, and people come with us just to sit in mud pools.
So it's sort of giving yourself over, isn't it, to every, and accepting every sensory feeling that comes your way.
Yes, and there's a huge aspect of mindfulness, which is really quite a buzzword these days, about there's a sense of meditation and peace within there, but there's also that point about really being in the moment. And that's where your sixth sense comes up that you talked about earlier.
Yeah, the gut feeling
is your sixth sense, but it's actually because all five senses are talking to you at any one point of time. And if something's not quite right, one of those senses would be going, hey, like this. Mm. And you've got to be able to be very in tune with yourself often to recognise those nuances in your senses. And there's certain conditions or certain ways of being where people aren't in touch with their senses. And for example, in severe addictions, you'll find people don't even know when they're hungry or thirsty. They've lost that complete sense of self and the sensory world that we live in.
So when you take people on these forest bathing courses and they interact with wolves, what's been the most remarkable change in a person that you've seen yourself?
I think from the research that we've done is it's probably, we did some research with 92 people that came on wolf medicine. Reduction in anxiety was the biggest drop, and that reduction in anxiety was maintained for up to 2 months. We tested your cat. It's beautiful. She wants to join in.
Yes,
you see.
Yes,
she is. About cat therapy. Yeah. So we found the reduction in anxiety was the main thing, and the other thing is people have what's called a paradigm shift. It is, and a paradigm shift is, a paradigm is how we see the world around us, the reality of the world, and how it exists around us. And sometimes when people, especially when there's depression present or severe anxiety, people get a paradigm of the world as being a very negative place. And there's a whole dialogue, internal dialogue, that goes around about the world being a negative place. And for example, we're talking about wolf medicine and addictions. That is, in that particularly, it's I can't get clean, I can't shake this addiction, and that's the paradigm. What we found in wolf medicine was a massive shift in paradigms, from people being able to say, I can't, I won't, I just can't do it, to, yes, I can see a better future. I'm more in touch with myself, I feel more connected, less isolated. I have people around me that I've met on wolf medicine, because people bond very strongly when they do that course together, like a pack. They form their own pack and looking out for each other. So when the course ends, they've still got the strength of the pack around them, which helps them move forward in terms of being able to see a brighter future for themselves, a future that they want for themselves.
And is this something, anybody listening, is this something, I know you said the wolves live in Reading.
Yeah.
But is this something, I know you operate here on the island, so can they do the forest bathing, for example, on the island with you?
Yes, yes. They can do the whole wolf medicine course, and then the 21st, so that's five consecutive days. Ideally, we ask people to sign up to that because right at the outset, because that helps them understand the concept of what we're trying to do, some of the science behind on that, because I'm talking to four people instead. But they can come along for that medicine program, and then they can come on any of our nature quests. So we do a range of nature quests, from dancing with horses to mud bathing in the mud pools, and we visit the Cave of Secret Carvings. There's all sorts of different and unique types of quests they can come on. And I just add a little bit into that. When we did the initial work with people that have been in the armed forces that had experienced PTSD, we found they needed high adrenaline. They didn't want to go just watching butterflies or, you know, just dipping their toes in the sea. They wanted something that gave them high adrenaline, which quite intrigued me, because you would imagine that's the last thing that they want if they suffer from traumatic stress. But actually, the body gets so used to being bathed in all this adrenaline and cortisol, have to do something higher than that to actually feel alive.
I imagine, is it a bit like an addiction that they're so used to that, it's very hard for them to...
Absolutely.
And presumably they were that sort of person when they undertook that career.
Absolutely.
That's what they craved, wasn't it, that rush.
Yeah.
And then to...
So we've had people leaping out of aeroplanes and all sorts. You know, if people suggest to us that's what they want to do for a nature quest, we're trying to do our best to accommodate it.
And how do people find you, Kim? How do they find out about this? I mean, obviously they're finding out about now, but how would somebody ever get on these courses?
Well, we're on. We've got a website called naturetherapycic.com. The CIC stands for Community Interest Company. Which means it's a not-for-profit social enterprise. Sometimes we have funding, so we can say these things are entirely free, and other times we charge a small amount, but we try to only charge a minimal amount so everybody has a chance to actually be able to do these things if that's what interests them.
And is it something that would be recommended through organisations such as AA or...
Yes,
GP, are they aware of this kind of thing?
The GPs are aware of some of the work we do. They may not be aware of the full range of work we do, because that's been evolving over the past few years as we've been working with people to try and for them to try and help us develop to what they need. So, for example, we've been working with children in schools on an anti-bullying project. And we do run a program for older people with dementia, all involving nature. So the GPs may not be aware of the full extent. But with the wolf medicine, we've worked well with IRIS, which is the centre for people that have addiction problems, and with the 12-step approach, they've been referred to us as well. And with mental health services. So we've worked really in a quiet partnership with these organisations.
Because your background is you were a nurse, a midwife and a teacher working with vulnerable children and adults. So you come, you know, you have got a lot of credibility, and obviously you're a doctorate in health science. So I'm just thinking, you know, people talking about wolf medicine and bathing and, you know, forest bathing, is there a degree of skepticism that you have to overcome with some people?
Yes, Joni, that's very true. Interestingly, I'm just thinking of one case in particular when we'd applied for funding, and it was right at the outset with the armed forces, and someone quite high up in the armed forces said, oh, nature therapy, that's just chasing butterflies. And I think right from the outset we've tried to say, no, these are unique sensory experiences that are based on scientific knowledge that we have to date. But this scientific knowledge is actually being shown to be quite relevant today, but is actually can be, you know, centuries old in some of these practices, that makes you think that maybe people were far more knowledgeable years ago than we are today.
Yes. And it's, I guess you've got, it's evidence-based, isn't it? And proof. Absolutely. You have proof of people making remarkable changes in their lives from this.
Yeah. All the work we do is evidence-based. So we look at things like psychodynamic theory, wilderness theory, all these technicalities and scientific theories and programs. But we also do our own research. So we want to know that what we're doing doesn't cause any harm, that only causes benefit, only creates benefits, not causes benefits.
That's brilliant. Well, thank you very much. We'll be back after this break with more from Dr. Kim Brown. Thank you, Kim.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Vectis Radio, FM 104.6, the heart of the island's community.
The White Military and Heritage Museum in Northwood. The museum will excite your senses and immerse you in a world of human success over adversity. Call 01983-300037 for more details or to book your ride.
As a business, you have a legal responsibility to dispose of your waste in line with current government legislation. Island Environmental Hygiene Limited are an island company specialising in the collection of sanitary, clinical and hazardous waste, working closely with the Environment Agency to ensure your waste is disposed of legally. Our services are tailored to meet your needs. To find out more, visit islandhygiene.com or call 721 943.
Isle of Wight Food Bank provides emergency food and support to local people in crisis. Your support helps stop local people going hungry. For more information, ring the office on 01983 292 040 or check out isleofwightfoodbank.org.uk/.
Do you suspect there may be some bullying going on within your company? Have you wondered what, if anything, you can do to stop it? Break the Cycles one-day workshop, Thriving in the Workplace, is the solution to any bullying that may be impacting the smooth running of your organisation, leading to increased staff turnover. There may be negative PR for your company if it's associated with bullying and nothing is done. For more information about this one-day workshop on workplace bullying, click breakthecycle.org.uk or email hello@breakthecycle.org.uk. Or you can call us on 01983 754 666 for an informal chat.
Vectis Radio, FM 104.6, broadcasting from the Riverside Centre in Newport, giving people the opportunity to broadcast no matter their age or ability. We make entertaining radio whilst offering affordable advertising for local businesses. Vectis Radio. VectisRadio.com.
This show is sponsored by Narconon UK.
Call Narconon today at 01435 512 460. 01435 512 460.
Hello and welcome back to this week's edition of Wit, Wisdom and Pratfalls with me, Joan Ellis, and Dr. Kim Brown, my guest, who is Founder Director of Nature Therapy CIC. Welcome back, Kim.
Thank you, Joan.
We were talking before the break about wonderful things, wolf medicine and forest bathing and all this sensory therapy, as you were saying, was evidence-based and helping people with very severe sort of mental health issues, but not necessarily. Just people who perhaps lack confidence in their lives or direction.
Yeah.
So it's a whole spectrum.
And what we tend to do is say to people, if you feel you'll benefit from it, then by all means, feel free to come along.
Yes.
We don't actually do any assessments on people or set any strict criteria for their attendance. So they don't even have to say why they want to come. They'd be welcome.
Okay.
Whatever.
And obviously, sort of working with wolves is quite extreme. But in a day-to-day life, just listening to you talking earlier, I'm thinking it's something a lot of people, we naturally go towards that way, don't we? We have dogs as pets. We have cats. We do like getting out into the outdoors and convening with nature and doing the garden and looking at beautiful scenery and sitting on the beach and walking by a lake and walking through a forest. So we're naturally drawn to it, aren't we? And
yes.
I think we realise it does calm us down. And so it's very interesting that this. I don't know, you just think it's got a feel-good factor, but it's very interesting that it's got this scientific evidence behind it.
Absolutely, Joni. And the sad part is that we've known this for thousands of years, that we have a natural affinity with our environment, with the natural world around us. We've never seen ourselves as separate, but as our culture and society's grown, so we've become very separate from nature and scared of natural environment, almost disconnected in some ways. And that disconnection from our natural world is really shown with our level of mental distress, our growing levels of mental distress. And you see this particularly in children and young people. And as you mentioned earlier, that was the field that I did work in for some time, was child and adolescent mental health, and worked as an advisor at the Home Office on that particular aspect. And that's how I first became interested in nature therapy, was I was seeing this huge disconnect for children, the stress we put them under with the schooling system now, and playtime is becoming where we used to go out and play in the playground or play after school. That's now becoming more taken up with homework and schoolwork.
And looking at tablets.
And computers, yes. Where we're living in virtual reality and not a sensory reality.
Yes, I mean, we see this as progress, don't we? Sort of industrialization and now this whole new, you know, world of technology. Yet, as you say, what that does, it puts a distance between us and the natural world.
Yes.
And we can't all earn our livings sort of on the land. But ideally, I suppose that would be, I don't know, that would be a perfect scenario in your case, I guess.
Well, in my case, it would just be to be able to take that time out and feel that environment. And some of the things that we do with people, that's not the end of it. They don't just do a one-off session with us. That's what they'll go away once they start to understand a bit more about forest bathing. You know, take the family out into the forest and take the family up to the top of the downs or walk along the beach and those types of things. I mean, families do that. I'm not saying, I'm not knocking them, but it's just trying to get that more regularly into our routine. And with older people, so of course, as people age, often they withdraw into their homes and have less chance to actually be able to get out and experience the wilderness more.
And even, I think, keeping a pet, which of course you know helps them with their loneliness and companionship, but that can be quite challenging, can't it, with elderly people, because they know they can't get out and exercise them, and they can even be quite a tripping hazard, can't they, small dogs and things with elderly people.
That's true.
I think they realize perhaps that they can't look after them any longer, so then they don't have a pet, and then that's got the consequences for them in that. But you have just had some wonderful news, haven't you? You've had £100,000 funding from the big lottery.
Yes. Now, that's to run a programme with older people that have cognitive impairments, such as a dementia. And that programme is particularly heartwarming for me because I started work over 40 years ago at Whitecroft, as it was then on the island, as a student nurse when I was about 17. And I...
What was Whitecroft then?
Whitecroft was at the old psychiatric hospital. Right. It's now been built over flats and apartments that are out there. And the old psychiatric hospitals were interesting because they were beautiful settings, all of them. And they actually gave people time out from the stresses of life. But they were institutions. And when I look back all those years about how we worked alongside people with dementia, it actually it makes me well up a bit, because I realised that everything we did, even with the best attentions back then, was against what physiologically they needed with dementia. So the programme that we're running and that we've done a lot of research and work on and building up to is around sensory impairment in dementia. So, for example, everyone knows that at some point words become fragile and memories get lost and people struggle to try and recall things. What's often not understood is that each of our senses also has a memory. So, for example, hearing is formed before we're even born, and there's a memory to that sense. So The program we run is a sensory program using nature, because that's less frightening for people. They understand nature. They've often, a generation that we're with now, have often grown up quite feral, running around in outside, and children nowadays don't get that same chance. So we use natural resources to give them sensory experiences. We also help carers to understand that how that sensory impairment might affect a particular individual. So, for example, sense of smell will often go in certain types of dementia a couple of years before there's even a diagnosis. And so we work with people to help them understand what happens when and smells are lost. For example, the most prevalent one is you can't smell smoke anymore. So you need to make sure if someone's living at home, they've got smoke detectors.
That's really important to know, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah.
I didn't know that.
What happens is once the senses start to become impaired, something called sensory deprivation happens. Now, sensory deprivation they use as a form of torture.
That's right, it's very negative, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's called white torture. And we know that we can induce hallucinations and challenging behaviour in as little as 15 minutes if somebody's subjected to sensory deprivation.
So this is where you see the sort of bag over somebody's head.
Yeah, noise being fired at them. They've got no sense of where they are. They're tipped around. And yes, it's supposed to be illegal in this country. But you hear occasional reports of people being exposed to sensory deprivation.
So that proves absolutely conclusively how reliant we are on that, doesn't it? Those five senses.
Yeah. And what happens is if in dementia, what we used to do years ago, we put people in these big Buxton chairs to keep them safe. So we put them into a chair, put a tray across them, and then tipped the chair, which ultimately confused them. They didn't know where they were. Nobody came when they called. They only saw the ceiling. So we were actually inducing separate.
So they were sort of strapped into a chair. With the best intentions,
to keep them safe. And then they were given medication that made them extremely sensitive to the sun. So if they went out into the sun, this was to try and control some of the challenging behaviour. And I'm not denying that behaviour can be incredibly challenging.
Yes,
and if it's someone that you love, it's
very distressing. It's distressing to see the aggression.
So they couldn't even go outside. So, you know, those last years of their life, or actually, you know, last months of their life, were often spent enclosed in a ward with a noise and smells, and all of those senses were actually not catered for in a gentle and respectful way.
And how do you think that's changed, or how? What will you be doing to kind of work with that?
Well, we'll be doing to raise awareness around sensory deprivation, first off. And we'll be running programmes of nature-based activities. So the ideas that people can do either at home with their loved one. And what was fascinating about the research we did is we found that in the carers, that they were often at a serious level of compassion fatigue, which is burnout, basically.
Yes.
And giving them nature-based activities to do with their loved one increased their levels of compassion fatigue. So they actually were less likely to burn out. So when burnout does occur in people caring for people with dementia, that's often when crisis occurs for the person with dementia.
So how does that actually work then? I mean, it sounds wonderful.
I know. It wasn't something we were expecting to find, but we did find it. It's because it's almost as if you've said to the carer, here's permission to go outside in the woods and collect fir cones so that you can make something together. Or here's permission to go and look for stones or to sit out in the garden. That's enough just to sit out in the garden and listen to the birds. So it could reduce their stress levels. It wasn't intentionally set out originally to do this for carers, but it was an impact of doing nature therapy with people with dementia.
So it's almost lifting that stress off them, isn't it?
Yeah. And also, I think what people were telling us anyway is that they realise it's not personal, because often when you're caring for someone you love, you can think they're just doing that to be awkward, they're just doing that to be difficult, and they don't understand. And there's a certain period in dementia where people with dementia might laugh if you hurt yourself. They have inappropriate reactions, which is painful if that's someone you love. So part of it was also saying, this isn't them, that's their sensory perception that's changing. Their reality is changing around them.
And I think that's very hard for people to understand, isn't it? Because what's going on in front of their eyes is something very different to what you're trying to explain, isn't it? So the evidence in that moment in front of their eyes is very harsh and very different. So that, and people's tastes change, don't they? Their sense of taste
changes. Their sense of taste changes, Joni, this certainly with certain types of dementia, they particularly like very salty things or very sweet things. And there's one dementia where they just eat continuously. So people have said they've had to lock the fridge because they would just eat the contents of the fridge. And another thing is, because the vision changes, so visual perception changes, if you give someone a meal on a, say, white mashed potato and white chicken on a white plate, they can't actually see it because there's not a difference in the colours.
And so, it's even remembering to eat and having that desire to eat, isn't it? There's so much. Oh, it's just a terrible, terrible illness. And again, how can, I know you've got your website, but would people with dementia and the carers be referred to you?
Yes, we'd love to hear from people. We've got some funding now, and we're going to train up some volunteers to deliver the programme. We can deliver the programme free of charge in residential homes, in the hospital. We've been very warmed by some of the staff at the hospital that's already taken part in our training, and what things they've implemented there to try and make a difference. And we've got
what sort of things, for example?
So one of the examples is we get people to make kokedama. And kokedama is it's the art, Japanese again, the art of string gardening. So you get plants, you wrap moss around them, and then you wrap string around them. So you've got the very physical aspect of gardening. So you can do that indoors, you don't have to go outside.
So it's sort of macrame and gardening together.
All mixed up. And then what happened in the ward is they hung them from the ceiling because they weren't safer to leave them lying around in case people took them and tried to eat them or whatever. But they actually hung them from the ceiling, so it gave a much fresher, greener outdoor environment within the hospital ward. It was really heartwarming to see.
Lovely. And going back to your wolf medicine, it's not quite the same, and obviously it wouldn't be appropriate to bring packs of wolves into care homes, but they did have a pat dog at one of my mum's old care homes, which was delightful. And he used to come in, Billy he was called, and everybody loved him. And his party trick was to stand on his hind legs and play the piano. And he'd go from one end of the keyboard to the other. There was a bag of treats at the far end, but he would tinkle the ivories at the drop of a hat, which was lovely. And you would see these residents light up, and it made such a difference.
With the research that we have show that once people go into residential homes, that there was a piece of French research that showed, can you imagine how often people are touched, older people are touched, physically touched, other than if something is being done to them, like washing and things. And the French study showed in France it was less than a minute a day. So that we crave often that physical touch. We know it boosts our immune system. A baby lamb would die if it's not licked and touched. And so animals provide that very, very needed touch and that stimulation that we wouldn't get otherwise in some of the residential homes. I have to say we have some brilliant ones on the island, but and in some of the other areas we work in.
This is, you're introducing something very new, aren't you? And a very different way of looking at things.
There's a wonderful new project out at the moment, and it's by Bodsters. They do the equine work. So obviously we do equine therapy within the wolf medicine. But Bodsters are now taking horses into some of the residential homes, and there's some lovely work Bodsters on the island. They're based in Godsdale. We put up some super videos around the work they do. You see people's faces just light up, which is what you said happened.
When my mum was in the hospice, we weren't there, sadly, at the time, but they did take us, somebody took in a Shetland pony. And I don't know if it was Bodsters. I don't think it was just a random person roaming Newport with a Shetland pony. But anyway, they went in and one of the nurses thought to take a photo. And Mum's stroking this pony, and they've got it in the atrium. But even then, when Mum was just so desperately ill and she couldn't speak, she hadn't spoken for 18 months, but she's looking at it saying, what is this horse doing indoors? You know, which is really lovely. She's stroking it and very pleased. But, you know, and you think, well, that's a really good reaction. Yes. You know, why on earth is there a horse indoors? But it was there purely to make her happy, which was really
And now she's making you happy too, because I see your face light up talking about it.
Yeah, it was really special, isn't it? Yeah, and they had the three little Shetland ponies there on the open day for the Mountbatten Hospice. Well, it's just Mountbatten now, isn't it? But yes, I think I would imagine Mountbatten would be very open to all this kind of new. But it's not new, like you say, it's ancient. But it's bringing it back into vogue, isn't it? And making people very aware of the benefits.
I mean, it's very ancient, but in the 16th century, the Quakers did set up sort of nature therapy centres across Britain, because before the treatment of people with mental illness was just unbearable. People chained to walls and, you know, but the Quakers were the very first forerunners of being able to take people back to nature and gentle them back into life.
There was a programme on TV, it was last night, it was slightly different to what you're talking about, but there were two office workers and they escaped. One went off to a fish farm in Scotland and the other girl went off to a ranch in north of Mexico, and both swore they would never come back into that kind of office 9-to-5 life and be penned in like that. They wanted a different way of life.
I like the way you described it as escaped as well. It feels like that when you get out.
yes, and it's so unnatural. But in our quest to achieve, in our quest for money, in our quest to survive, we are often driven down paths that we don't necessarily would choose naturally.
No,
but we perhaps have to take a different path in order to maintain a lifestyle and keep body and soul together, and that's put food exactly on the table, don't we? And pay our bills. So it's not necessary where we want to go. And I was interviewing one of the farmers here on the island, Todd Carter.
Oh, Todd.
Todd, Motherston, and his wife, Jackie. And I said, is there anything else you'd have liked to have done had you not done farming? Because he's done it sort of man and boy. And he said, well, I'm unemployable now, but, you know, because he said I'm so sort of nobody would want me the way I am. But he just couldn't contemplate. He couldn't think, even though it's a 365 day a year job in all weathers, he couldn't think of anything he'd rather do.
No.
And neither could Jackie.
No. So, and of course they're both outside and
and working with animals.
Yeah.
So they've kind of got it all going on, haven't they?
And both extremely knowledgeable about nature.
Yeah. But it's often sort of a lot of, and I'm not speaking for all of them, but a lot of kind of younger generation, the millennials, the idea of going for a walk outside and getting some fresh air, heaven forbid, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, and always spend a day on the beach. Is that what do we want to do that for? Yeah. You know, probably won't get a signal, and how boring is that gonna be? So it's incredibly interesting. It's brilliant. Okay, we're just going to have a very short break and then we'll be back with Dr. Kim Brown afterwards and hear more about her life here on the Isle of Wight. Thank you.
Vectis Radio, FM 104.6, Isle of Wight's community station.
Island Harbour presents The Breeze Restaurant and Bar. We offer a variety of delicious foods which can be enjoyed inside the recently refurbished restaurant or outside, overlooking the picturesque marina. Start your day well with something from our breakfast menu. Enjoy afternoon tea with a slice of freshly made cake, or drop by for an evening meal with the family. We offer a range of tasty British classics with a choice of daily specials. Our produce is locally sourced to ensure quality and taste. The Breeze Restaurant and Bar, one of the Solent's best kept secrets. Call us today on 533-388.
The Four P's Project is proudly supported by Wheeler's Solicitors, helping you achieve your aims in life. We deal with residential and commercial conveyancing, wills, lasting powers of attorney and probate. For more information, call us on 01983 533 938 or check out wheelers-solicitors.com.
This is Vectis Radio, the Isle of Wight's local community station. In 2013, Vectis Radio set up the Four P's Radio School, designed to train young people aged 11 to 19 in four crucial areas of radio: presenting, production, promotion, and podcasting. Hence the Four P's. The course is also available to people with additional needs, up to the age of 25, helping young people gain confidence and skills that will help them as they move forward in life. To find out more, visit www.4ps.org.uk. This is Vectis Radio. For the people, by the people.
It was a well-paying job, respectable, wearing a suit and tie every day. But I drank 24/7. Drank on the way to work, drank at work.
I never could come to terms with admitting that I had an alcohol problem or a pill problem.
I decided to get clean, and so I went to the Narconon program.
Not only did I handle my drug addiction, I completely knew how to live life.
Call Narconon today at 01435 512 460. 01435 512 460.
Devoted to the Isle of Wight, this is Vectis Radio, FM 104.6.
So welcome back, Dr. Kim Brown, Founder Director of Nature Therapy CIC here on the Isle of Wight. You've got quite a lot of accolades to your name, haven't you?
I've been very fortunate in my chosen career journey. Some years back, I decided I wasn't going to go to school anymore. So by the time I was 14, I stopped going to school. And I used to go to the library instead and learn a lot of different things. But of course, it didn't give me any qualifications when I first left school.
How did that go down with your parents? I've got to ask.
Well, well, they didn't know, to be true.
Ah, oh, it's coming out now.
Yes. So, of course, all my study and all my work's been done later in life. And I chose nursing as a career and psychiatric nursing initially. And I started that when I was 17. And the reason I went into psychiatric nursing is I tried a business studies course at the Isle of Wight College and thought, I can't do this for the rest of my life. That's not what I want to do. I want to work with people. And my stepfather had family that was at Whitecroft, and we used to visit. So I was very used to going to Whitecroft. So I got on my push bike from Ryde, cycled up there and said, can I have a job as a nurse, please? And they went, yes, of course. Can you start Monday? And that's what I did. I started as a nursing auxiliary on the Monday on a psychogeriatric ward, as they called it then, because a lot of people were very fearful about mental illness. But because I'd grown up around it, I didn't find that fear. I didn't associate it with fear. I associated it with nice nurses giving me jelly and ice cream and visiting people that could act a bit odd at times, but you know, you just accept that when you're a child anyway. So I think I've been really fortunate that I started off with a fantastic career, and over the years I've gone from psychiatric nursing to general nursing, and I've worked in different places. So I worked in different casualty units, for example, in London. Travelled to the States and studied. I've had different awards, travel awards and scholarships. Mm. And so I think if anybody sat there now thinking, oh, I wonder if nursing's for me, I'd say yes. It opens a multitude of doors for you if that's what you're considering.
But it's not for everyone, is it?
No, it's not for everyone. And it's hard sometimes to know who it's for and who it's not. And it's hard to know that for yourself, because I've known people go into general nursing and then suddenly faint at the sight of an injection or blood, which they didn't realise that they were that would happen to them. And they've had to move on from that. So not everybody can take it. But I have to say, I've had some wonderful mentors down through the years as well, which it's been amazing. You know, people down through the past 40 years.
And you were Nurse of the Year?
Yes, I won a Nurse of the Year award. That was a a few years ago now, I lose track of time.
And National Venus Award for Inspirational Professional of the Year.
Yes, and that was for setting up the dementia programme, which I thought was wonderful. Absolutely wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, it must be, it's a great feeling to be recognised for your efforts, isn't
yes.
it? I mean, I know that's not what you do it for, but to have that recognition.
And also to think somebody nominated me. I don't know who it was.
To this day, you don't know?
I don't know, no. I kept trying to ask the Venus ones, but no, somebody nominated me, so thank you for doing that.
And that also adds weight to what you do, doesn't it? And gives you credibility,
yes.
gives you kudos, so yeah. that people can sort of trust, you know, even more in what you're doing
yeah.
and what you're saying. And you say that the nursing opened doors. If you hadn't gone down this, I know you went down a sort of more business orientated at start, but is there anything else, a burning passion within you that you'd have liked to have done?
I would have loved to have done anthropology. When I was younger, sort of in the early 60s, there wasn't really any female role models around. But I found a woman called Margaret Mead, who travelled to Samoa, and she broke all the sort of traditions at the time.
Was she an islander?
No, she was a famous anthropologist.
Right.
And she studied sex in Samoa, which, of course, in itself was just dreadfully scandalous. But I thought she was fascinating because there was a lack of women that you could look up to and admire and think, well, if she can do it, I can do it. And yes, I would have liked to have been an anthropologist. And I have managed to weave that into my life in a lot of ways, in terms of travelling to remote places and staying with the different tribes I've stayed with in, you know, Native American. And yes, so I've managed to.
Yeah, it's funny how that often happens,
yeah.
isn't it?
And actually, I hadn't thought about it too. You mentioned it.
And you're here on the island, and obviously this is somewhere that really lends itself to the sort of work you do,
yes.
doesn't it?
Yes, yeah.
What is it about, because you're an islander, aren't you, Kim?
I am. I was born in Ryde, on Ryde seafront, my poor mum.
On the beach?
Just off the beach, apparently. In a storm.
Goodness me. Yeah. So this was completely unexpected that you were coming at that moment.
Yeah, I was only tiny. I was a premature and a bit tiny. So
oh, wow.
I've made up for it since.
Oh, your poor mother, bless her. But who came to your mum's aid then? That must be quite a story in itself.
Oh, she got into the house.
Oh,
so,
I see.
Yes.
And
yeah.
She didn't give birth to you alone, did she?
No, I'm not sure. I think my grandmother was there. So,
yeah.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So what is it for you about the island that keeps you here?
Well, it's the same as about, I was talking about the nature. It's that sense of connection, the roots that I have here. Some of my roots go back here for generations, and our large family that I'm sort of, you know, I'll think, well, that person's a cousin when I walk past them. But more so it's that sense of connection to the land. And I have a great interest in ancient Celtic history as well. And of course, we have over here in Bryston, we have a mass of connections around Celtic history here.
Is that the Longstone? Is that part
yes,
of that?
Yes, we've got the Barras, the Longstone. I've just written a book for families around King Arwald and the ancient Druids that were here. So I have a real interest in that. And of course, again, it fits with the nature therapy because it's very much about the land and the basis of the land.
And what's your favourite spot? Your go-to place?
My go-to place. I am truly blessed to have some land in Bryston, and it just runs up towards, it runs up over the down into Bryston Forest, and just to sit there on that piece of land is just, I think, I couldn't wish for anything more.
And do you have a favourite beach? Are you a beach girl?
Oh, yes, yeah, lots of beaches. My favourite's Rockan End, which is actually a naturist beach, but you can walk from Rockan End through to Whale Chine.
Is this the one? Oh, I do, right, okay,
yes.
It's not Blackgang.
Well, it is down below Blackgang, but it's called Rockan End, and you can walk along that stretch of beach there. But to swim it, there's a riptide that
runs
down
through
there.
Oh, I know, I've been victim of that. Yeah.
Have you? Well, if you get in the water and get the riptide right, it will sweep you right down the beach.
But you need to know what you're doing for
yes,
that one, Kim. And
yes.
Clearly, as a townie, I didn't.
Oh, right. Oh, dear.
Yeah. Well, it's been an absolute joy talking to you, Dr. Kim Brown. Thank you so much for your time and for enlightening us to, you know, kind of getting back to nature. I think it's really lovely, and I think it's great you find out you've been on a naturist beach. It's all sort of come full circle, haven't we, quite literally. And thank you so much for listening. I've been Joan Ellis, and enjoy the sunshine. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.